While, 1,000 miles to the east, the Merrimack, Virginia, steamed back from her first sortie, leaving the burning Congress to light the scene of wreckage she had left in Hampton Roads. Various fragments of his army retreated north and east and west, swinging wide to avoid their late opponents when they turned back south to reach the Boston Mountains. Though unpursued, they took a week to reassemble near Van Buren. Back at his starting point in the foothills of the Ozarks, Van Dorn counted noses and reported his losses as 1,000 killed and wounded, 300 captured. He was by no means willing to admit that the battle had been anything more than a temporary setback. Least of all could it be considered a defeat. "I was not defeated, but only foiled in my intentions," he told Richmond. Still with his main goal in mind, he was ready to try again, this time by marching boldly and rapidly toward St. Louis, between Ironton and the enemy's Grand Depot at Rolla. Within another week, March 23rd, he was heading north with 16,000 effectives when he received a peremptory order to turn east, crossing the river by the best and most expeditious route, and join the concentration being effected in North Mississippi by Johnston and Beauregard after their long retreat from Kentucky. "Your order received," Van Dorn replied, pleased, no doubt, at the prospect of exchanging the wilds of Arkansas for the comparative comforts of his native state. Unlike his opponent, who was as dashing or as slapdash on a retreat as in an advance, Curtis had not been satisfied to report his casualties in round figures. That would have been neither respectful to the dead nor indicative of sound administration. Consolidating subordinate reports, which showed that Carr's division had suffered more than the other three combined, he prepared a careful table: killed 203, wounded 980, captured or otherwise missing 201, total 1,384, and forwarded it to Halleck, declaring that he had completely routed the whole rebel force, which retired in great confusion, but rather safely through the deep, impassable defiles. He did not speculate, as others would surely have done in his place, especially Van Dorn, on what the future might reveal as to the importance of the victory he had won at Elkhorn Tavern in the shadow of Pea Ridge. That was not his way. Besides, he had no means of knowing that Van Dorn would be called east beyond the Mississippi and would not be coming back. He did not claim, as in truth he could have done, that he had secured Missouri to the Union for all time, that guerrilla bands might rip and tear her, that raider columns of various strengths might cut swathes of destruction up and down her, but that her star in the Confederate flag, placed there like Kentucky's by a fleeing secessionist legislature, represented nothing more from now on than the exiles who bore arms beneath that banner. Though he did not deal in military imponderables, other imponderables were another matter, those of nature, for example. Spring had come to upland Arkansas at last, and it put him in mind of the ones he had known in his Ohio boyhood. The day after the battle, a warm rain fell, washing away the bloodstains, but as the burial squads went about their work, the air was tainted with decay. Curtis moved his headquarters off a ways once more to enjoy the singing birds as he sat at a camp table writing home. "Silent and sad," were words he used to describe the present scene of recent conflict. "The vulture and the wolf have now communion, and the dead, friends and foes, sleep in the same lonely grave." So he wrote, this highly practical and methodical engineer, looking up at the tree-fledged ridge with its gray outcroppings of granite. He added that he hoped it would serve hereafter as a monument to perpetuate the memory of those who had fallen at its base. South and west of Pea Ridge lay Texas, where Van Dorn had first shown dash and won success. North and west of Texas, twice the size of that vast Lone Star expanse, the territories of Utah and New Mexico stretched on beyond the sunset to the California gold fields and the shores of the Pacific. In the minds of most, this sun-baked half-million-square-mile wasteland with its brackish lakes and its few thirsty rivers was of less than doubtful value, fit only as a breeding ground of lizards and Apaches. Others knew better, Jefferson Davis, for one. Believing in his Union days that the nation's destiny pointed south and west, he had engineered the Gadsden Purchase and even imported camels in an attempt to solve the sandy transportation problem. Now in his Confederate days, the nebulous future being translated into terms of the urgent present, his belief was reinforced. Out there beyond the sunset lay the gold fields and the ocean. Control of the former would establish sound financial credit, on which the South could draw for securing war supplies abroad, while the opening of Confederate ports along the Pacific coast would ensure their delivery by stretching the tenuous federal blockade past the snapping point. Satisfying as all this was as a solution to present problems, an even more dazzling prospect still remained. Having forged its independence in the crucible of war, the new nation could then return to the old Southern nationalist dream of expansion, acquiring by purchase or conquest the adjoining Mexican states of Chihuahua, Sonora, and Baja California. After these would come others, less near but no less valuable. Cuba, for instance, then Central America, and all that lay between. Van Dorn seizing St. Louis as a base for a march through Illinois to subdue the Middle West. Beauregard dictating peace terms in the White House after the Battle of Cleveland or Lake Erie. Glorious as these scenes were to contemplate in the mind's eye, they were pale indeed, in contrast to the glittering light of victory by way of California. None of this could be accomplished, however, until safe passage west had been assured at the start by clearing federal troops from the territory of New Mexico. The answer to this, as Davis knew, lay in control of the Rio Grande. It was therefore with considerable pleasure, 2 months after Sumter, that he welcomed to Richmond a 44-year-old Louisiana-born West Pointer, Henry H. Sibley, lately Major, U.S. Army. Indeed, from Davis's point of view, the caller might have tumbled straight out of heaven into the arms of the Confederacy. He had come to offer his services, preferably for duty in the region where he had been stationed for years, commanding various forts throughout the Southwest and along the Rio Grande. An enterprising officer, he had invented a conical tent modeled after the wigwams of the Sioux, and he had kept busy in other ways out there. What was more, he had a plan. And as he told it, a stocky, wind-burnt man with a big-featured face and a heavy mustache that grew down past the corners of his mouth so that his aggressive chin looked naked as a heel, Davis might have been listening to the echo of his own thoughts on the dazzling possibilities of victory by way of California. Granted the authority, Sibley said, he would raise a force in Texas and set out northward from El Paso, capturing forts along the river all the way to Santa Fe. This done, he would consolidate and turn west, his ranks swollen with volunteers whose watchword would be "On to San Francisco." Davis liked the sound of it and was more than willing to grant him the authority he asked. Unfortunately, however, that was all he had to offer. The government could spare no arms or munitions. In fact, it could spare no equipment at all. The ex-major would have to scrape together what he could find in Texas on his own, then make up the balance out of enemy stores from the forts he took as he marched upriver. No matter how fruitful the project promised to be, it would have to be self-sustaining. Davis made that quite clear at the outset, before granting the authority. In early July, 2 weeks before Manassas, Sibley was made a brigadier and assigned to command the Department of New Mexico. Like much of his equipment, the department itself was still in Union hands, but that would be corrected, too, when he had accomplished the first stage of the plan he had outlined in the president's office. Davis wished him Godspeed, and Sibley returned at once to Texas, where he recruited a brigade of 3 mounted regiments by the end of the year and set out for El Paso, the jump-off point for his campaign to control the Rio Grande. Two men, David E. Twiggs and John R. Baylor, had accomplished much for him already, before and since his trip to Richmond. Twiggs, a federal brigadier in command of the Texas Department during the secession furor, had repeatedly asked Washington for instructions through that stormy time. Receiving none, he acted in accordance with a statement he had made. If an old woman with a broomstick should come with full authority from the state of Texas to demand the public property, I would give it to her. He did just that, surrendering all the troops, forts, and equipment in his charge, not to an old woman, but to a posse of citizens who styled themselves a Committee for Public Safety. Northern howls of treason to the flag went up, and Twiggs, being summarily dismissed from the U.S. Army, repaired forthwith to New Orleans, where he was solaced and rewarded with a commission as a Confederate Major General. In time, a portion of this surrendered equipment was inherited by Sibley, who needed it badly. Meanwhile, Baylor, his other helper, had kept as busy as the first, issuing a blanket invitation to whoever would join him on what he announced as a 1,000-man buffalo hunt in Old Mexico. He showed his commission as a Confederate lieutenant colonel to the 350 volunteers who turned up, swore them in, organized them into a regiment called the Texas Mounted Rifles, and marched them to El Paso in time to receive the surrender of Fort Bliss across the river from the Mexican hamlet. Upstream, the Rio Grande was divided like the nation, north and south, and Baylor saw in this a chance to accomplish a great deal more. For some time now there had been a movement among New Mexicans to split the territory along the 34th parallel and detach the southern portion as Arizona. Since in general the people of this lower region favored the Confederacy, he decided to go up there and help them, adding thereby a future new state to his new nation. There was one problem. 40 miles upriver from El Paso, just this side of the village of Mesilla, Fort Fillmore blocked the way, its garrison of 700 U.S. regulars commanded by Major Isaac Lind, a veteran of 34 years in the infantry. Undeterred at being thus outnumbered 2-1, Baylor spent no time musing on the odds. In mid-July, while Sibley was on the final leg of his round-trip journey to Richmond, the Texan led his mounted rifles north. On the night of the 24th, though the Federals had been warned that he was coming, he camped unmolested within 600 yards of the fort on the opposite bank of the river, then next morning splashed across and occupied Mesilla. When Lind at last marched out to challenge the invaders, the townspeople, who had greeted Baylor with vivas and hurrahs, climbed a nearby hill to watch the contest. After demanding an immediate surrender and receiving an immediate refusal, the gray-bearded major sent one squadron forward in a tentative head-on charge that was repulsed with 4 men killed and 7 wounded. As a battle, it wasn't much, but it was quite enough for Lind. Abandoning any notion of holding the fort, he fired a few short-falling rounds in the direction of the hill where the ungrateful and unarmed men, women, and children were cheering the secessionists, then ordered a retreat northeast to Fort Stanton, 150 sandy miles beyond the Organ Mountains. Next day, displaying what one of his officers called a sublimity of majestic indifference, he was taking lunch at San Augustine Springs when he discovered that the empty fort had been no more than a tub to Baylor's whale. The Texan wanted the soldiers, too, and was there at hand, demanding their surrender or a fight. Lind decided the former would be best. After paroling the 492 officers and men taken here, the other 200-odd had already been picked up as stragglers, Baylor returned to Mesilla and on August 1st issued a proclamation establishing the Confederate territory of Arizona, with the 34th parallel as its northern boundary, and himself as its military governor. Richmond quickly sustained his action, and Congress welcomed the delegate who soon arrived to represent the new far western territory. Such, then, was the situation Sibley found awaiting him when he reached Fort Bliss in mid-December with his newly recruited brigade. Between them in their different ways, Twiggs and Baylor had accomplished much of his project for him already, supplying his men with surrendered equipment and clearing the Rio Grande well beyond the Texas border. Fort Stanton's garrison had withdrawn to Albuquerque, while the Unionists at Fort Thorne, 50 miles above Mesilla, had retreated 80 miles upriver to Fort Craig, which now remained the only prepared defensive position in Federal hands below the boundary parallel. Once it fell, the others to the north should fall like toppled blocks. Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and Fort Union, eastward beyond the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. At Fort Craig, he knew, 4,000 troops were preparing to move against him, with perhaps as many more in support beyond the parallel. He himself had 3,700, including Baylor's. Yet he was no more discouraged by these odds than Baylor had been by longer ones. 3 days after New Year's, he marched northward, 4 regiments in a long mounted column, and within the week he occupied Fort Thorne. The rest of the month was spent developing the situation. Then, on February 7th, he set out for Fort Craig, where the Federals were massing. His purpose was offensive. He did not intend to surrender the initiative. On the 19th, after a series of probing actions by his scouts, the main body came up and made camp on an open plain across the river from the fort on the west bank. The stage was set for the first major clash to determine who would control the Rio Grande. That night, when the wind was from the east, Confederate voices could be heard across the water by the troops inside the fort. Colonel Edward R.S. Canby was in command, not only of the fort but also of the whole department. And this was only the latest of his trials since the advent of secession. He had taken over by appointment upon the departure into enemy ranks of the previous commander, W.W. Loring, the one professional in the quartet of prima donnas who brought grief to R.E. Lee in West Virginia. Indiana-born, tall, clean-shaven, and soldierly-looking, with mild manners and a big nose that dominated his otherwise surprisingly delicate features, Canby was a year younger than Sibley and had finished at West Point a year behind him. Thrust into command at the outbreak of hostilities, he had about 1,000 territorial militia, poorly armed and even more poorly trained, to supplement the scattering of peacetime regulars stationed at the various posts and forts in his department. Supplies were as scarce as distances were vast. Consequently, while Baylor took Fort Bliss and then Fort Fillmore, Canby could do nothing but work with what he had in an attempt to strengthen his defenses, meanwhile sending out repeated calls for volunteers. All this time, Sibley was raising soldiers down in Texas. For what purpose, his opponent knew all too well for his mind's ease. By the end of the year, Canby had 5 regiments, recruited by prominent New Mexicans, Kit Carson was one, and sent them out to bolster such remaining scattered strong points as had not been abandoned or surrendered during the build-up. All through January, he continued his preparations to move southward from Fort Craig. Perhaps he might even have done so in time if Sibley had not spared him the risk and trouble by moving north against him, arriving February 19th, and making camp within earshot of the fort on the opposite bank of the Rio Grande. In expectation of a siege, Canby spent the night making his strong position even stronger, preparing to repulse the attack which he believed would come at dawn. It did not come. Instead, as the light grew, he looked across the river and saw, between him and the rising sun, enemy wagons rolling north. Sibley was bypassing the fort, leaving it and the Federals inside it to wither on the vine, while he moved northward into the unprotected region on beyond the parallel, the region whose protection was Canby's primary assignment. What he had seen out there between him and the rising sun left the Union commander no choice. He himself would have to attack, to fight without the defensive advantage of the adobe walls he had been strengthening all this time. Accordingly, he sent a regiment up the western bank under orders to cross the river 5 miles upstream and charge the rebels, who he believed were moving north across the Mesa Valverde in March column. In this he was mistaken. Sibley had not intended to go north without at least an attempt to cripple any enemy force he left behind. He was maneuvering for a crossing and an assault against the fort. But now that Canby had obliged him by coming out for a fight in the open, Sibley was appreciative and ready. Crashing through the rust-colored reeds on the eastern bank, then charging up the slope onto the mesa, the Federals found the Texans waiting with double-shotted guns. Cannon and rifle fire broke up the attack in short order, the blue troopers scattering for what little cover they could find. They clung there under sniper fire through what was left of daylight and withdrew after dark to report to their commander that the rebels were still there, very much so, in fact. The two-day battle of Valverde was half over. For Canby, that first day had begun in error and ended in repulse. Now, at least, as dawn of the second came glimmering through, there would be no error in estimating the enemy situation. Sibley was there, outnumbered, and he would attack him. He sent three more regiments up to join the first, with orders to force the crossing in strength and whip the rebels, still drawn up on the mesa within musket range of the river. He had not wanted this kind of fighting. These 4,000 men were all he had to protect the whole southwest. But now that it could no longer be avoided, he was determined to make the work as short and decisive as possible, no matter how bloody. It was far from short work, but it turned out bloody enough. After losing a good many men at the crossing, they came under a galling fire, and the bodies of men and horses floated slowly downstream, bumping along in the shallow water. They managed to get their guns across and with them knock the enemy back into the sandy ridges at the far edge of the mesa. From there, the Texans tried cavalry charges against the flanks and dismounted charges against the center, the sand-polished rowels of their spurs as big and bright as silver dollars. Past midday, the charges continued. All were repulsed. Then at 2:45, Canby himself came up from the fort, bringing the remaining regiment. He assumed command just as Colonel Tom Green, on the other side, took over from Sibley, who had become indisposed, from the heat, some said, while others said from whiskey. Whichever it was a Confederate advantage. Green was an all-out fighter. He put his cavalry out front, massing behind them all the dismounted men he could lay hands on, and sent them charging all together against a six-gun battery at the north end of the Federal line. For 8 minutes, one participant said, the fighting was terrific beyond description. By then, Green's men were among the guns. The battery officers and cannoneers were dead. When the Texans turned the captured pieces against the line they had so lately been a part of, it broke badly, one Confederate declaring that the Northerners, in their haste to reach the west bank of the river, became more like a herd of frightened mustangs than men. Once again there was slaughter at the crossing and more bodies floating sluggishly downstream in the blood-stained water. Green was reassembling his elated troopers, preparing to use what was left of the short, hot winter day to butcher or capture what was left of the rattled Federal army before it could reach the fort 5 miles downstream. He got his men together and was about to charge the enemy drawn up shakily on the opposite bank, when a truce party came forward under a white flag. Canby requested an armistice, time to care for the wounded and bury the dead. His chivalry thus appealed to, Green agreed to the ceasefire, and while the defeated New Mexicans retreated under its protection to the adobe fastness of Fort Craig, the victorious Texans rifled the knapsacks of the fallen, bolting Yankee light bread and other most delicious eatables, washed down with whiskey found in the canteens of the Union dead. Darkness fell, the battle was over. The men poured the sand from their boots and took their rest. Recovered from his indisposition next morning, Sibley found that Green had left it to him to decide whether to go after the survivors in the fort, bagging the lot, or turn his back on them and continue the march northward. Federal casualties had been 263, Confederate 187, but the victory had been even more decisive as to proof of who would fight and who would panic under pressure. The opening phase of the campaign to seize the Southwest as a base for operations farther west had been accomplished. Ahead lay the chief cities of the region, Albuquerque and Santa Fe. As Sibley saw it, such poor soldiers as Canby's were not worth the time that would be spent in completing their destruction. He gave his Texans a full day's rest as a reward for their exertions, then pressed on north without delay. Within a week, having paused to establish a hospital for his wounded at Socorro, just beyond the boundary parallel, he had covered the 100-odd miles to Albuquerque. He had good reason for haste. This was desert country, where loss of a canteen or a last handful of crackers could be as fatal as a bullet through the heart. And he had left Valverde with only 5 days' rations in his train. Fortunately, he had encountered no enemy soldiers on the way. Apparently, they had heard what had happened to their friends the week before and were falling back from contact. Then, as he came within sight of Albuquerque, he saw something that affected him worse than if he had seen a whole new federal army drawn up for battle on the outskirts. 3 great columns of smoke stood tall and black above the town. Anticipating his arrival and his hunger, the Union garrison had set fire to their rich depot of supplies when they fell back on Santa Fe that morning. He moved in unopposed and took the place, scraping together what few provisions he could buy or commandeer in order to continue the movement north. 4 days later, March 5th, he occupied the capital. Here, too, he was unopposed. The garrison pulled out on the eve of his arrival. All Sibley and his Texans got of the Santa Fe depot was its ashes. The burnings had been done under orders from Canby. When he fell back on Fort Craig under cover of the flag of truce on the night of his defeat, he sent couriers to the northward posts with instructions that all public properties, and particularly provisions, were to be destroyed as soon as the invaders seemed about to come within reach. He knew this country and what it could do to an army without supplies. Having tried stand-up fighting at Valverde and having lost, he adopted now a scorched-earth policy, one not difficult to apply in a region where the earth was already scorched enough to burn the sole off a boot in a morning's walk. Sibley's men were already feeling the pinch. Nor were the discomforts of short rations, threadbare clothes, and sand-leaking boots relieved by any considerable sympathy from the people of Albuquerque or Santa Fe. Expecting cheers and volunteers at the end of their long victory march, the Texans instead had found the atmosphere definitely unfriendly ever since they crossed the parallel. The Southern commander's prediction that troops of sympathizers would come marching in to join him, miners and trappers from Utah Territory and beyond, had by no means been fulfilled. In fact, there were rumors that groups there were organizing to join the other side. Sibley was finding that all he won with victory was miles and miles of sand. Still, he had done nearly all of what he set out to do in preparing a base for the conquest of the Far West. Those miles and miles included the Rio Grande and the territorial capital. Except for the stunned remnant of Canby's army, still cowering inside the adobe protection of Fort Craig, all that remained was Fort Union, 60 miles east of Santa Fe, beyond the foothills of the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, so called because their slopes were the color of blood each day at sunset. Fort Union had been the rallying point for all the garrisons Sibley had flushed from their accustomed posts. By now he knew it was held in strength, and he figured he would have to fight to take it. Preparing to do so, he advanced a picket of 600 men from Santa Fe, 20 miles southeast, to the mouth of Apache Canyon, which led on to Las Vegas, the new capital, and Fort Union. They were to hold the canyon mouth, preventing any federal advance, while the rest of the Confederates were being assembled to join them. Then they would all go forward together to wipe out the final enemy stronghold. Preparations continued through most of March. Then, on the 26th, the picket got word that a small force, 200 New Mexicans and about 200 regulars, was coming through the canyon for an attack on Santa Fe. It sounded too good to be true, but the Texans were not missing any chance to give the Yankees another drubbing. They mounted up and rode forward, taking two guns along for good measure. 4 miles up the canyon, they caught sight of what they had been told to expect. A column of 400 Union troopers riding foolhardily within gun range of a body of seasoned Confederates who had them outnumbered 3-2. There in the rocky trough of the pass, the Texans formed their line for slaughter. Slaughter it was, but not as had been intended. Suddenly, one wrote his wife, Federal infantry were upon the hills on both sides of us, shooting us down like sheep. They had been sucked into an ambush. As they fell back, startled, they could see up on the overhead ledges enemy sharpshooters jumping from rock to rock like so many mountain sheep. Losing men at every attempt to take up a new position, they were near panic, not only because of the bullets, but also from sheer astonishment. New Mexicans, Mexicans, they called them with all the contempt a Texan could put into the word, had never fought like this. Then they discovered something else, which startled them even more. Instead of Mexicans and regulars, they were regular demons, in the form of Pike's Peakers from the Denver City gold mines. That was what they were, all right, recruits from frontier mining towns. First Colorado, they called themselves, 1,342 volunteers, with one battery of field guns and another of mountain howitzers. They had made a long, cold, wet march to reach Fort Union. On the same day, Sibley pulled into Santa Fe at the end of his long, hot, dry one. After 2 weeks of sandy drill in the vicinity of the fort, they felt ready and came looking for a fight. Now they had it here in Apache Canyon. The Texans had finally rallied and were making a last-ditch stand near the mouth of the canyon. Drawn up in a strong position behind the moat of a dry stream bed, they felt ready at last for whatever came. What came was the Federal cavalry. Released from decoy duty, they came riding fast, leaped the arroyo, and landed among the defenders, hacking and shooting. The Texans broke and fled, all but 71 who surrendered, bringing their casualties to 146 in all. The Coloradans had lost a total of 19. While the Federals withdrew to meet reinforcements from Fort Union, the Confederate survivors sent out news of the disaster, which brought two regiments hurrying next day to their support. By dawn of the third day, March 28th, the main bodies of both armies were moving through the canyon from opposite directions. An hour before noon, they met at Glorieta Pass, a terrible place for an engagement, a northern lieutenant afterward remembered. A deep gorge with a narrow wagon track running along the bottom, the ground rising precipitously on each side, with huge boulders and clumps of stunted cedars interspersed. Maneuver was impossible. All the two forces could do was scramble for cover and start banging away, the tearing rattle of pistol and rifle fire punctuated cacophonously by the deeper booms of cannon. Neither could advance, yet both knew that to fall back would be even more fatal than to stay there. For 5 hours the fighting continued in a boiling cloud of rock dust. Then an armistice was called to permit care for the wounded and burial of the dead. The Texas commander had proposed it, and during the lull he received word of a calamity in his rear. A party of 300 Coloradans, led by a former preacher, had circled around behind the hills and come down upon the Confederate supply train, capturing the guard, burning the 85 provision-laden wagons, and bayoneting the nearly 600 horses and mules. In addition to Yankees, the Texans now would be fighting thirst and starvation. Against those odds, they pulled back under cover of the truce and got away, out of the canyon and up the road to Santa Fe. The Federals, who had inflicted 123 casualties at a cost of 86, were all for going after them up to the gates of the capital itself. But word had come from Canby at Fort Craig. He feared an attack on Fort Union by some roundabout route, perhaps across the eastern plains from the Texas Panhandle. They were to hold that final stronghold at all hazards and to leave nothing to chance. Grudgingly, the Coloradans obeyed, retracing their steps back through the canyon where they had fought and won two battles. 4 days later, April 1st, the day McClellan took ship at Alexandria for his overnight voyage to the peninsula, Canby left Fort Craig at last, marching north on Sibley's 5 weeks-old trail. He was a brigadier general now, promoted as of the day before. On the 8th, he arrived before Albuquerque. Sibley was ready for him, having been there all the while with half his army. The two exchanged artillery salvos, and Canby retired beyond the nearby Sandia Mountains, calling for the Fort Union garrison to come out and reinforce him. Sibley, likewise, sent word for the Glorieta survivors, licking their wounds in Santa Fe, to join him there on the banks of the Rio Grande. Both armies thus were concentrating within 1 day's march of each other. The great winner-take-all battle of the Southwest, to which all that had gone before would have served as prologue, seemed about to be fought near Albuquerque. It was never fought, either there or elsewhere, and for several reasons, mostly Sibley's. The countryside was too poor to support an invading army without the help of the people living there or supply lines leading back to greener regions, and he had neither. Rather, the inhabitants were unexpectedly hostile, more inclined to cash their scant provisions than to exchange them for Confederate money, which they considered worthless. Sibley's artillery ammunition was nearly exhausted, and his wagon train had been destroyed. The recruits he expected had not appeared, or if they had, the Pike's Peakers, for example, they came against him wearing blue, so that the numerical odds were even longer now than they had been at the outset. Perceiving all this, he saw his dream dissolve in the encroaching gloom. There was but one thing left for him to do with his ragged, ill-fed, weary army. Get it out of there and back to Texas. He was by no means certain that he could manage this, however, depending as it did on whether he would have the cooperation of his opponent. He got it in full. Canby, having fought once at Val Verde, wanted no more fighting he could possibly avoid. Sibley began his retreat on April 12th, crossing the river with his main body to make camp that night 20 miles south on the west bank at Los Lunas. Next day, having stayed behind to bury their brass field pieces, for which they had neither shells nor powder, the remainder followed down the east bank to Peralta, nearly opposite. Canby marched in pursuit, his reinforcements having arrived that day from Fort Union. He was not trying to cut the rebels off and then destroy them. The last thing he wanted, in fact, was for them to turn and fight or even stop to catch their breath. What he wanted was for them to leave. The sooner the better. He wanted them out of the territory for whose protection he was responsible. At Peralta, coming upon the smaller Confederate segment, he gave it a nudge. As we galloped across the bottom toward them, they fluttered like birds in a snare, a Coloradan wrote. But that was all. When they scurried across the river, then turned south with the main body to continue the retreat, Canby turned south too, but he remained on the eastern bank. For 2 days the retreat continued in this fashion, the two armies marching in plain view of each other, often within cannon range, on opposite banks of the fordable Rio Grande. Canby's men were outraged, shouting for him to send them across the river to slaughter the tatterdemalions who had been so arrogant 2 months before, when they were headed in the opposite direction. The northern commander was deaf alike to protests and appeals, however passionate. If there was to be any killing done, he would rather let the desert do it for him. Beginning with the third day, the desert got its chance. When the Federals woke to reveille that morning near La Jolla, they could see campfires burning brightly across the river. Dawn showed no signs of life in the camp, however, and after waiting a long while for the Texans to begin their march, Canby sent some scouts across, who returned with news that the camp was abandoned. The rebels had left in the night. Sibley, it appeared, had wanted a battle even less than Canby did. Approaching Socorro with Fort Craig only a day's march beyond, he had left under cover of darkness in an attempt to shake his pursuers and swing westward on a 100-mile detour to avoid a clash with whatever troops the fort's commander might have left to garrison it. Canby did not pursue. He knew the country Sibley was taking his men through, out there beyond the narrow valley benches. It was all desert, and he was having no part of it. He marched his troopers leisurely on to the safety and comfort of Fort Craig, arriving April 22nd. By that time, Sibley's Texans were at the midpoint of their detour. Canby was content to leave their disposal to the desert. It was one of the great marches of all time, and one of the great nightmares ever after for the men who survived it. They had no guide, no road, not even a trail through that barren waste, and they began the 10-day trek with 5 days' poor rations, including water. What few guns they had brought along were dragged and lowered up and downhill by the men, who fashioned long rope harnesses for the purpose. For miles, the brush and undergrowth were so dense that they had to cut and hack their way through with bowie knives and axes. Skirting the western slopes of the Madalenas, they crossed the Sierra de San Mateo, then staggered down the dry bed of the Palomas River until they reached the Rio Grande again, within sight of which the Texans sent up a shout like the Thalassa of Xenophon's 10,000. From start to finish, since heading north at the opening of the year, they had suffered a total of 1,700 casualties. Something under 500 of these fell or were captured in battle, and of the remaining 1,200 who did not get back to Texas, a good part crumpled along the wayside during this last 100 miles. They reached the river with nothing but their guns and what they carried on their persons. A northern lieutenant, following their trail a year later, reported that he not infrequently found a piece of a gun carriage or part of a harness or some piece of camp or garrison equipage, with occasionally a white, dry skeleton of a man. At some points it seemed impossible for men to have made their way. Sibley reached Fort Bliss in early May, with what was left of his command strung out for 50 miles behind him. Here he made his report to the Richmond government, a disillusioned man. He did not mention the California gold fields or the advantages of controlling the Pacific coast. He confined his observations to the field of his late endeavor, and even these were limited to abuse. Except for its geographical position, the territory of New Mexico is not worth a quarter of the blood and treasure expended in its conquest. As a field for military operations, it possesses not a single element, except in the multiplicity of its defensible positions. The indispensable element, food, cannot be relied on. Nor did he express any intention of giving the thing another try. The grapes had soured in the desert heat, setting his teeth on edge. "I cannot speak encouragingly for the future," he concluded. "My troops, having manifested a dogged, irreconcilable detestation of the country and the people." The report was dated May 4th. 10 days later, he assembled the 2,000 survivors on the parade ground, all that were left of the 3,700 Texans he had taken north from there 4 months ago. After thanking them for their devotion and self-sacrifice during what he called this more than difficult campaign, he continued the retreat to San Antonio, where he took leave of them and they disbanded. It was finished. All his high hopes and golden dreams had come to nothing, like the newly founded territory of Arizona, which had gone out of existence with his departure. Any trouble the Unionists might encounter in the upper Rio Grande Valley from now on would have to come from rattlers and Apaches. The Confederates were out of there for good. As far as New Mexico and the Far West were concerned, the Civil War was over. All this time, while Sibley and Van Dorn were undergoing their defeats and suffering frustration of their plans, Beauregard kept busy doing what he could to shore up the western flank of the long line stretching eastward from the Mississippi River. Loss of Henry and Donelson, along with the troops who were charged with their defense, had irreparably smashed its center, throwing left and right out of concert and endangering the rear. "You must now act as seems best to you," Johnston had told him. "The separation of our armies is for the present complete." He was alone. Gloomily, the Creole left Nashville on February 15th. 2 days later, the day after Donelson fell, he passed through Corinth, the Northeast Mississippi Railroad nexus, on his way to inspect Polk's dispositions at Columbus. But his sore throat got sorer from anxiety and exposure, forcing him off the train at Jackson, Tennessee. From a hotel bed, he summoned the Bishop General to join him for a conference. Waiting, he was downcast. Now, indeed, as he had said, the ship of state was on the breakers. When Polk arrived, Beauregard informed him that Columbus must be abandoned. The bishop protested. He had spent the past 5 months strengthening the Gibraltar of the West for just such an emergency, he said. But his fellow Louisianian explained that the manpower expense was too great. The 17,000-man garrison must fall back to New Madrid, 40 miles downriver near the Tennessee line, where the swampy terrain would require less than half as large a defensive force, freeing the balance to assist in restoring the shattered center. In desperation, Polk then offered to hold Columbus with 5,000 men. Beauregard shook his head. It would not do. They would be bypassed and captured at leisure, cut off from assisting in the defense of Memphis, which seemed next on the federal list of major downriver objectives, or from cooperating with Johnston, who was retreating southwest with Hardee's troops for a possible conjunction. Polk returned to his fortified bluff, as heavy-hearted now as his commander, and set about dismounting his heavy guns and packing his wagons. Orders were orders. He would retreat, but not without every ounce of equipment charged against his name. Beauregard's new line, covering Memphis and the railroads running spoke-like from that hub, extended generally north-northwest along the roadbed of the Mobile and Ohio, from Corinth on the right, through Jackson and Humboldt, Tennessee, to the vicinity of New Madrid on the left. To defend this 150-mile airline stretch, he had only such men as would be available from Polk's command when they pulled out of Columbus. As he examined the maps in his sick room, he saw that despite the renewed advantage of a railroad shuttle from flank to flank of his line, he was worse off even than Johnston had been in Kentucky. However, his spirits rose as his health improved, until presently he had recovered his accustomed Napoleonic outlook. Back in Nashville, he had seen the problem. We must defeat the enemy somewhere to give confidence to our friends. We must give up some minor points and concentrate our forces to save the most important ones, or we will lose all of them in succession. To relieve what he called his profound anxiety, he addressed on the 21st a confidential circular to the governors of Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, unfolding for them a plan that would transmute disaster into glorious success by turning the tables on the Yankees. If the governors would send him reinforcements to bring his strength to 40,000, he would take the offensive forthwith. He would march on Paducah, then on Cairo, and having taken those 2 points, he would lay St. Louis itself under siege. This last would involve Van Dorn across the river. Describing the project and invoking his assistance, the Creole general inquired of the Mississippian, "What say you to this brilliant program?" Van Dorn's reply came 2 weeks later in the form of a dispatch giving news of his defeat at Elkhorn Tavern. This ruled out any chance of his cooperating in an advance against St. Louis, even if the governors east of the river had been able to send the troops requested, which they had not. But Beauregard did not relapse into his former depression. He kept busy, issuing rhetorical addresses to his soldiers and rallying the populace to resist the cruel invader. In an attempt to repair his shortage of artillery, for example, he broadcast an appeal to the planters of the Mississippi Valley for brass and iron bells to provide metal for casting cannon. "I, your general, entrusted with the command of the army embodied of your sons, your kinsmen, and your neighbors, do now call on you to send your plantation bells to the nearest railroad depot, subject to my order, to be melted into cannon for the defense of your plantations. Who will not cheerfully and promptly send me his bells under such circumstances? Be of good cheer. but time is precious. This produced more poetry in Southern periodicals than bells in Confederate foundries, but the general refused to let his spirits be dampened, even by such taunts as the one his appeal provoked in the pro-Union Louisville Courier. "The rebels can afford to give up all their church bells, cowbells, and dinner bells to Beauregard, for they never go to church now. Their cows have all been taken by foraging parties, and they have no dinner to be summoned to." Polk, meanwhile, was completing his preparations to evacuate Columbus, working mainly at night to hide his intentions from prying enemy eyes. This was no easy task, involving as it did the repulse of a gunboat reconnaissance on the 23rd and the removal of 140 emplaced guns and camp equipment for 17,000 men, but he accomplished it without loss or detection. By March 2nd, the heaviest guns and 7,000 of his soldiers having been sent downriver to New Madrid, he was on his way south with the remainder. Within the week, he reached Humboldt, the crossing of the Mobile and Ohio and the Memphis and Louisville railroads, where he stopped. From here, his 10,000 troops could be hurried to meet whatever developed in any direction, either up where they had just come from, or down at Corinth, or back in Memphis. Little as he approved of retreat in general, the militant churchman had shown a talent for it under necessity. The detached 7,000 saw less cause for gladness on occupying the post assigned them around New Madrid. Rather, it seemed to them on arrival that they had been sent to the swampy back end of nowhere. After they had been there a while, however, they began to appreciate that the difficulty of the terrain was what made the position especially suitable for defense. Both banks of the river were boggy swamps, impenetrable to marching men. Besides which, the Mississippi itself collaborated with the defenders to render its placid-looking chocolate surface something less than convenient as a highway for invaders. As it approached the Kentucky-Tennessee line several miles upstream, the river began one of its compass-boxing double twists, like a snake in convulsions, describing an S drawn backwards and tipped on its face, so that the two narrow peninsulas lay side by side, the one to the west pointing north, the other south. Off the tip of the former, across the river in Missouri, lay the town of New Madrid, whose three forts, mounting 7 guns each, commanded the second bend. At the tip of the other peninsula, nearer the Tennessee bank, was Island 10, so called because it was the 10th such in the 40 winding miles below the mouth of the Ohio, whose 39 guns, including a 16-gun floating battery tied up off the foot of the island, commanded the straight stretch of river leading into the first bend. Beauregard placed much reliance on those 60 guns. They constituted the twin-fluked left flank anchor of his tenuous line. The next defensible position was Fort Pillow, another 100 miles downriver. Engineers had been ordered there to constrict the fortifications so that they could be held by 3,000 troops instead of the 10,000 for which they had been designed in the palmier days just past. That would take time, however. For the present, as Beauregard saw it, the fall of the batteries at New Madrid and Island 10 must necessarily be followed immediately by the loss of the whole Mississippi Valley to the mouth of the Mississippi River. His instructions were that they were to be held at all costs, which in soldier language meant that those guns were worth their weight in blood and must be served accordingly. Polk thought so too. Forwarding heavy guns and reinforcements, he expressed his hopes and confidence to a colonel whose regiment had been stationed in the area all along. "Your position is a strong one, which you have well studied, and I have no doubt of the vigor and efficiency of your defense. Keep me informed." Another who agreed was Commodore Andrew Foote. He agreed, in fact, with both of them, with Beauregard in stressing the importance to the Confederates of their river line defense, and with Polk in expecting that it would be conducted with vigor and efficiency, taking full account of all the advantages in their favor. The Federal flag officer had had time to think the problem over. After the sudden victory at Henry and the abrupt repulse at Donelson, He had returned to Cairo for badly needed repairs, both to his battered gunboats and to himself. The fall of the forts, having delivered the whole Tennessee-Cumberland water system into Union hands, he could now give full attention to the Western Navy's primary assignment, the clearing of the Father of Waters, all the way to the Gulf. This would be a much harder job than what had gone before, and the Commodore knew it. For one thing, there was the distance. From the mouth of the Ohio to the mouth of the Mississippi was about 500 crow flight miles, but it was well over twice that far by the twisting course his boats would have to take. A tawny vastness lay before him, winding south beyond the enemy horizon, with various obstacles in and on and around it, natural and man-made. For another, there was the difference in the rivers themselves. The Mississippi ran swifter, and it ran the other way. This meant that he would have to fight downstream, in which case even a slight mishap, such as a fouled rudder or a sudden loss of steam, could lead to destruction or capture. Highly vulnerable except from dead ahead, his ironclads carried little armor back from the prow and none at all at the stern. What was more, experiments conducted on the Mississippi during the refitting showed that they could not maintain station under reverse power, even with the help of anchors, which could get no firm purchase on the river's slimy bottom. If one of them went out of control in a downstream fight, through breakdown or damage to her engine or her steering apparatus, she would not drift rearward to safety, as 3 out of 4 had done in the upstream fight just past, but forward under enemy guns and into enemy hands. Consideration brought doubts, when his brother, a judge in Ohio, reminded him that the public expected dash and close fighting, something sharp and decisive. Foote replied, "Don't you know that my gunboats are the only protection you have upon your rivers? That without my flotilla, everything in your rivers, your cities and your towns, would be at the mercy of the enemy? My first duty, then, is to care for my boats, if I am to protect you." He had not spoken thus before the point-blank assault on Donelson. But now, with the wound in his ankle not yet healed, and the sound of breaking armor still loud in his memory of that repulse, the Commodore took counsel of his fears. Despite his qualms, Foote set off downriver before daylight, March 4th, prepared to assault the Columbus Bluff with all 7 of his ironclads. Arriving, he found the fortress strangely silent. No stir of life on the ramparts and no metal frowning down from the embrasures. 2 officers and 30 men, covered by all the guns of the fleet, made a dash for shore in a tug, and presently returned, more sheepish than exultant, with word that the Union flag had been flying there since yesterday. Out on a scout, 4 companies of Illinois cavalry had found the place deserted, then trooper-like had settled down and made themselves at home, rooting into the conglomerate litter Polk's men had left behind. Foote went ashore for a look at the fortifications, wrote a formal report on their capture, supervised further repairs to his gunboats, necessary because the armor above the Texas decks was so badly cracked and buckled that the civilian pilots refused to continue downriver until it had been replaced. Then finally, on the 17th, set off again for his next objective, Island 10. Arriving that day, he moored his flotilla against the Missouri bank, 3 miles above the head of the fortified island, and began lobbing shells across the low-lying southern tip of the First Peninsula. His fire was not very effective at that range, but neither was the enemy's, which was the Commodore's main concern in his present frame of mind. In fact, he had come prepared for this style of fighting. His 7 ironclads were supplemented by 11 strange vessels, compressed hexagons 60 feet long and 25 feet wide, each with a single 13-inch mortar bolted to its deck. Originally, there had been doubts as to whether they would stand the recoil, but 3 of the gunboat captains had settled that by firing the first shot, in spite of which they were still suspected of being about as dangerous at one end of the trajectory as the other. When the piece was loaded, the crew slipped through a door cut in one end of the surrounding 7-foot armored bulwark, and stood on tiptoe on the outer deck, hands over ears, mouths agape, knees flexed against the concussion, until it was fired. Then they would hurry back inside for the reloading. Foot at least was happy with them, despite the doubts and drawbacks. As soon as he got within range of the island, he had them towed to the head of the column and started them firing in the direction of the nearest Confederate batteries, 2 airline miles away. Army men, who had been on the scene for 2 weeks now, anticipating the arrival of the gunboats with their Sunday punch, were much less happy about these new-style naval tactics. So different from what had gone before. At Henry, the Navy had taken the lead, leaving the landsmen with little to do. And now that the case was more or less reversed, the Army howled with resentment. As time went by, the Commodore refusing to budge from his upstream station, the howls took on a note of shrill derision. One exasperated colonel, when asked just what the flotilla was accomplishing, replied contemptuously, "Oh, it is still bombarding the state of Tennessee at long range." None among the soldiers was more critical of the Navy than their commander, Brigadier General John Pope. In protesting against caution, he stood on solid ground. His notion of the way to fight a war was to locate the enemy and then go after him, preferably point blank. These tactics were especially valid when operating, as Pope was here, with the advantage of 3-to-1 numerical odds, and he had proceeded to put them into practice. A 40-year-old West Pointer with a robust physique to match his positive manner, he had brought his 4 divisions overland down the right bank of the river, arriving March 3rd, and moved without delay against New Madrid and Point.